We greet you in the name of the lifted up Jesus this morning. I was given an assignment at Keysville a number of weeks ago. I was hoping to share the message here and get your critique on it before I went there. I prefer that critique to come from the people I know best. But it didn't work out that way, and so I listened to what they had to say and felt led to share that message this morning, and hopefully you're getting a slightly improved version of that. The title was The Blessings and Snares of Traditions. It's something we all face. Tradition is a very inclusive word. Every culture has tradition, every people group. If I would bow to you this morning as you come to meet me at the back of the church, you'd probably say, Howard, what's wrong with you? But there are cultures where that is a customary way. That is a traditional way of meeting people or saluting. Tradition includes things for meaning and remembrance. There is deep in the heart of all mankind to have tangibles that help them generate or maintain a loyalty to some organization or an awe and respect because of a tradition that they do or traditions that they do. That's why the Super Bowl always has a national anthem sung before it. It's part of their opening ceremony, and it's emotional. Then there are the biblical traditions, which takes a Bible principle, and we endeavor to do life in a certain way based off of what the Bible says. Maybe the purposes can eventually become a bit vague, and it's something we just do. We're not exactly sure what verse in the Bible this really applies to, because it just became a tradition, and it wasn't necessarily pointed out what it stems back to. The reason we embrace or fight against tradition can have a broad range of objectives and underlying motives that can be helpful or dangerous to the big picture of our spiritual life, how we view tradition, whether we're embracing it or fighting against it. The blessings and snares of traditions. I said that tradition, every culture has it. It's unavoidable. You see, for every tradition we stop doing, there is something that will replace it, and it's likely someone else's traditions or some other group's traditions. We will always be practicing tradition. If what our church, particular church, asks of us to do, we say we don't want to do it, we'll probably go out the door and embrace some Protestant tradition or some other tradition that is out there. The technical definition of tradition is the transmission of customs or beliefs from generation to generation, or the fact of being passed on in this way. From a theological perspective, is a practical belief to have divine authority, though not necessarily spelled out in the scriptures. So we see traditions theologically can have applications. Maybe there's not a exact wording in the Bible that says do it exactly the way we're doing it. Well, the title implies that tradition can have positive or negative repercussions, and I was to be thinking about both as part of this message. There is a snare of underlying motives. We are carnal-minded people. We have a heart that is prone to go wrong. And we can have some preconceived biases or some experience or some exposure that tends to want to filter in when we think about a tradition, want to factor in. I'm of the persuasion that more often than not, when evaluating tradition, there is a snare of underlying motives. And it's dangerous because of our preconceived biases. I'll start with a personal experience as a young man. I'm not old enough to to remember when Kennedy was assassinated. I was a little too young for that, but I was told that from the moment that Kennedy stepped on the podium and had the inauguration without a hat on, was a watershed moment in their tradition of wearing a hat. And I didn't piece that all together, but we lived close to what was a Bowman Hat Factory, and it was a company that was in decline, and I didn't understand that. And after a while, they changed their icon to a cowboy hat. Well, the fact was the cowboy hat was the only hat that was selling anymore after Kennedy's influence, after he changed the tradition. And there was eventually a conviction started forming, mostly among the younger men in the Mennonite circles, that the traditional black hat worn for traditional reasons had become a religious symbol and should not be worn in that regard. Men are not to cover their heads, the Bible says, in a religious symbolic way. So I grew up when that awareness was starting to form. The world was starting not to wear hats, and the church was starting to question what the hat meant. And there was a pushback to the idea that men should be wearing a hat that would identify as a religious symbol. And the church maintained that tradition. They kept promoting that tradition as a weather protection. Yes, it had some connotations to a people group or a subculture of Christianity, but it was primarily a weather protection. And a critical moment happened in my heart when I observed something. I observed one in my ministry get out of his car at church on a beautiful day and get his hat off the seat beside him and put it on his head to walk 30 yards into the church and then take it off again. And something happened in my heart at that moment that wanted to make me angry toward tradition. If that was weather protection, I didn't understand weather protection. And that was a dangerous moment for me, because from that moment on, I could find it very difficult to take advice from a God-ordained authority in my life. Now, I know if I would have seen a cowboy grab his hat off the dash of his truck and walk the same distance into a rodeo, I probably wouldn't have thought much of it. I probably wouldn't have had the same emotion. But see, I was going through something. I didn't want to wear that kind of a hat and mix it with Bible principles and all. There was something going on inside of me that held some value, I hope, but also some danger. What were my heart motives in that whole consideration? I hope obedience to the Bible was number one. I hope that was, but I know there were other conflicts. There were some carnal conflicts that were mixed in with that as well. And to this day, there's something inside of me feels very betrayed when I see someone wear a bill cap and not take it off to pray. And to this day, there's something inside of me that questions why a bill cap inside of a building or when you're eating. What is behind all this? Well, you're following a tradition. That's what you're doing. That's what we're doing. We follow somebody's tradition. Somebody's tradition. And we can become super critical of religious traditions, but we will go out on our own traditions that have a worldly connection in some way and be quite fine with it. Because contrary to cowboy culture, we don't want to be identified in our religious culture because it's not popular, it's not mainstream. And we can so easily become carnal in how we process tradition. Because tradition, Bible-based tradition, usually runs counterculture. Our embrace or pushback on religious tradition can have some common sense objective. There can be that. But it can very easily have a very carnal heart behind the common sense that we're projecting for why we'd like to do or why we'd like to change a long-standing tradition. Traditions have a goal. They are meant to maintain a norm of some kind. Whenever we change established norms, we open ourselves up to a new trajectory, because traditions are usually doing something. It will open up a door on the other side of the room that we may not have thought much about. It may impact future generations in some rather unsuspecting ways as we flippantly disregard what tradition has brought to our life to this point. A little secular illustration for this point. Today, the first thing that we do when we go into a large store is, I think most of us have no qualms grabbing a shopping cart. There's usually, some of these stores I know have baskets sitting there, but for me, I'll take a shopping cart. I like to lean on it, and it stands still when you're getting your stuff. You don't have to figure. So I'll grab a shopping cart. But you know, it wasn't always that way. America came through the Roaring Twenties and the Industrial Revolution, and everything was being geared for bigger and better, and the walk-in corner store where somebody served you and gave you what you came for and maybe showed you something new that they had that you didn't know they had, that was going away, and you now walked into the store and you got your stuff yourself, and more of the type of shopping that we do today. But on June 4, 1937, the world's first shopping carts were introduced at Humpty Dumpty Grocery Store in Oklahoma City. A grocer named Sylvan Goldman had a problem. He wanted to increase his clients' sales. He no longer could just introduce all the new stuff by getting it for them. But what he discovered is the women who came to his stores stopped shopping when their hand carry baskets were full. When the baskets were full, they were carrying on their arm, and then they were done shopping. He just noticed that was the way it was working. And he pondered the question, how could he grow his business by making it easier for women to shop? Bigger baskets seemed to be the answer, but then he knew they would get heavy and they couldn't carry them. And Goldman came up with a brilliant idea to put a bigger basket on wheels. So he used a folding chair type of a frame as his prototype. It was a bit clunky, but he figured it would make a good enough market test. And Goldman discovered that his target market was very resistant to this change. And he didn't understand why, so he started asking questions. Why aren't you using the cart right there inside the door, you know? And the answers he got varied. What it boiled down to is the ladies felt like they're pushing a baby cart in the store. That didn't fit their ego. And the men felt like they're too wimpy if they're walking around pushing a cart when they should be carrying a basket. So there was resistance. There was natural motives that they didn't like his idea. So he thought, what can I do? He still thought it's a good idea, that a cart on wheels should be a good idea. So what he did, he hired people, first of all, to make sure that they noticed the carts inside the door and offer them one. And also he hired pretend shoppers to go around shopping with a cart of the more elite class people, men and ladies. And after a while, they got used to this, and, you know, well, these well-dressed people are pushing a cart, and that man's pushing a cart, I guess. And shopping carts took off, and it ended up the shopping cart, I guess, made him more money than the grocery store did, and he died a very wealthy man. But why do I share that story? Well, I'm being in marketing, it's very intriguing to me how things get off the ground sometimes and what it all takes to do that. But the fascinating part is to me is what happened here in this story. On the implementation side, The whole implementation process was about greed. He wanted to get people to spend more than what they came for. That's really what he wanted to do. It was greed behind it. On the resistance side, it was about ego. The elite lady shoppers didn't want to look like baby-pushing moms while they were shopping, and the men didn't want to look like some wimp that couldn't carry a basket. But interestingly, when the cool people shopped with it, suddenly it became okay, and it became the new tradition. You took the cart instead of the basket. And today, that's what most of us, I would like to believe, do. We take the cart instead of the basket. Now, I gave that story because when it comes to embracing or resisting religious traditions, I think some of the amazingly deceptive things that were going on in people's hearts there can be going on in our hearts. And maybe some of the reasons that tradition is perpetuated beyond a useful range is because of some ulterior motives on the part of churches and their leaders. That is possible as well. Every religious culture has traditions. Every secular culture has traditions. If we want to be a part of the Church of Jesus Christ or the part of Hell's Angels Motorcycle Club, we will have to do some things that we probably wouldn't normally do because it's their traditions to be a part of their life. And it will take us somewhere into a subculture of some kind. It does. The cowboy wears his hat proudly. The God and country proponents fly their flags unapologetically because it's all part of deepening their cultural experience and inspiring loyalty to their brand. And they are proud of the display and they are not ashamed of it. The passage that they assigned me, you can turn to 2 Kings chapter 18, is one where tradition is viewed in a negative way. This is a place where brand loyalty got skewed to the point that what was a blessing to them became their God. And this can happen with traditions. When our faith is based on a doing rather than on Jesus Christ and his finished work, this can happen. Our traditions can actually become a God to us. 2 Kings 18 and verse 1 says, "Now it came to pass in the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. 25 years old was he when he began to reign, and he reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name also was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that David his father did. He removed the high places, and brake the images, and cut down the groves, and brake in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it, and he called it Nehushtan, a thing of brass. He trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor any that were before him. For he clave to the Lord, and departed not from following him, but he kept his commandments, which the Lord commanded Moses." So here we see that Hezekiah destroyed an artifact that was a gigantic moment of history, very important part of history of Israel. We talked about in Sunday school where that brass serpent was lifted up on a cross and people were dying left and right, and it was faith that saved them as they looked to that cross. And they were told, just look, and the snake bites won't hurt you. Just look. That's all you have to do. And it was a very, very important moment of time. There was a lot of salvation happened, physically speaking. And, of course, we know that that's pointing to Christ and how we can now look to him in faith and we can be saved. So to us, this is a very, very special artifact even. Not the artifact necessarily, but what it was symbolic of. But we see that for some reason, this artifact took on a very religious meaning to them. In fact, it became their god. And they started worshiping the very thing that was meant for just a look of faith. And there had to be some modifications made. And we see it was very drastic modifications. They ground it up and called it just a piece of brass. Just a piece of brass. This is not your god. Let's get rid of it. If you think it's your god, let's get rid of it. There's no saving merit in this. The tabernacle worship that God assigned is what we're to be doing. This is not what you're to be doing, where you're to be putting your faith and confidence. So liberal thinkers can look at a passage like this and like to abandon traditions that has served a past, but they don't believe serve a present time, and say it's time for change, and say let's just totally change it. Let's just totally abandon. And so it went for many Mennonite circles down through history. From the feet washing basins getting moved up into the attic or thrown out or burned or whatever, to the Christian salutation getting replaced with hugs and fist bumps and high fives, to the lapels and neckties replacing the plain suit, or written or oral standards about practical Christian living pretty much pushed over the cliff of Christian liberty, because tradition is a snare. It's a snare. We don't follow tradition, is what they would say. If it has served a purpose, then move on. Evaluating tradition and its place and work today, it's a very difficult process. Because traditions do something. They do something. Every time we have communion and we reach out for that bread and we take that grape juice, it should be doing something to us. It should be inspiring us. Every time we wash feet, it should be doing something. It should be helping us in our loyalty. Well, evaluating traditions, number one, I have just a few points. One of the blessings of tradition is it gives a foundation when facing alternate or radical worldviews. When you have a tradition, you at least have something that you're doing that you can say, okay, now why are we doing this? When it comes to traditions, basically it's a love or hate thing for most of us. If it's a tradition that is keeping what we want, it's great and we'll be defending it. But if it's a tradition that's standing in the way of what we would prefer, then of course we'll say it's awful and we'll want to abandon it and we'll come up with all kinds of reasons why it's not practical or whatever. Tradition takes a lot of heat. And for every person who loves a tradition, there's likely someone who hates the same tradition. This happened in 1 Corinthians 11. You can turn there. Well, maybe for the sake of time, I'll just read. 1 Corinthians 11, we know that's the chapter of the Christian woman's veiling. And we see a time that the church was being challenged. There was a desire to be more like their unchurched neighbors. Women wanted to cut their hair and get rid of their veil. And then it says in verse 13, judge in yourselves, is it comely that a woman pray unto God uncovered? Doth not even nature itself teach you that if a man have long hair, it is a shame unto him? But if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given her for a covering. But if any man seem to be contentious, we have no such custom, neither the churches of God. So we see here that there was an idea, a new idea came up that should the Christians really have to do this? Or could we do it like our neighbors are doing it? And they appealed to some common sense things. I mean, just think about it. Is it even comely that a woman would pray to God uncovered? I mean, that's not even natural. Nature itself says that it's a shame for a woman to have short hair. And then it says, but if you can't buy into that, just putting in my own words, just mark it down, The churches don't have a tradition that allows that. There is no such custom. They appeal to the tradition as part of the coming to a conclusion and negotiating a conclusion to what was being projected. Tradition has the potential to check new and radical thinking. We can at least say stop and say, no, wait, why are we doing this? There must be a reason that we started doing it this way. What will we gain or what will we lose if we would do it differently? And we try and think objectively. Number two, tradition creates a subculture that serves as a reminder to our sojourn and its loyalties. I recently went to a township meeting, and I've went to many of them over the years relating to the sign industry. But for many years, I didn't go to one where they saluted the flag. And here at this one, it was up on their screen that part of it was going to be saluting the flag. And yeah, start of the township meeting, they get up and they stood and they turned around and they did the salute. I stood respectfully, but my hand was down and my lips were not moving because I can't buy into that tradition. I can't pledge my allegiance to the USA. I can't do that. But for them, it was a reminder to their loyalties. They did it at every meeting. Why? Because they considered themselves public servants to a municipality, and they were responsible for taxpayers' money, and they were committed to doing what was right for America and its citizens. And they reminded themselves of that every time, every meeting. We do some things, too, that remind us of our loyalties. We baptize with water in front of an audience for witness. We reach out annually for a little piece of bread and a sip of grape juice to remind us of our loyalties and Jesus' sacrifice. When my wife and I decide to get married, we left a member of the ministry of body pronounce us husband and wife because it was more than just a physical union, earthly union that was being formed there. It has spiritual connections. Every time I slip on my plain suit without a tie, it serves as a reminder to me that I'm of a different kingdom. I'm not one and the same as the attorney down the street or the salesman that comes in the door or the president of the United States. I'm part of a different kingdom. A lot of times when we think about tradition, clothing tends to come in because styles change and things happen in society. And clothes in and of themselves do not make us a sinner or a saint, but they do serve as a reminder to our loyalties as we endeavor not to be totally mainstream. I looked at some pictures of the Citizens Park Stadium attendees in Philly. And from what it looked like to me, that's a t-shirt culture there. I would have probably been in the minority to be there in a button-down shirt. Can we be okay with traditions that are not mainstream? Because we are a part of a different kingdom. Can we be okay with that? Tradition can help us remember whose we are and who we serve. And maybe even help us to feel a little uncomfortable, depending where we would end up, where it has earmarks of another kingdom and not a place where we belong. Maybe tradition can help us if we let it. Number three, tradition can create a legalistic mindset that does not help us in our relationship with God. I hesitated to share this illustration, but I share it with great respect for the conference in focus. I recently went past a church that had all black vehicles, and I believe it's a tradition that may have its roots way back to when the Model T's started getting colored. I don't know exactly where that all started from, but it became a standard. It became a tradition for them. And as I looked at that churchyard just passing by, there were some vehicles that had factory aluminum wheels and door handles and mirrors, just like ours do. Some that had those blacked out in what appeared to be an attempt to hold on to a simple way of life, not a flagrant way of life. But it was also very possible. I went past rather quickly, so I couldn't see everything. But I would like to believe that it's very possible that in that parking lot there were vehicles that were downright worldly, but they were hiding behind tradition. And if their dad would have said that, no, you should not be putting aftermarket wheels on that are black, and you should so your caliber stand out more. You should not be putting spacers in. You should not be covering up all the chrome. You should not be, and they would say, well, tradition. This is what we do. But behind it would be a total carnal heart. And the low profile tires and everything else makes a total different vehicle than what the guidelines were meant to create. And it can happen. Culture does shift and move, and there's times that maybe as a people of God, we are more in tune with where culture is than at other times. But we daren't look to tradition. We daren't come to this checklist thing and say, I'm doing this and this and this and this, therefore I'm a Christian. We have to look, where are the influences coming from for what we're doing? Where are they coming from? Are we in tune with God, and are we trying to be not one and the same with the world? Or are we modifying our life so that we can fit more and more closely to the world? Number four, tradition can become a competition and a show instead of a spiritual aid. Matthew chapter 23, maybe turn to that. I'd like to read verses 1 to 8 there. Matthew chapter 23, verses 1 to 8. It says, then spake Jesus to the multitude and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do. But do not ye after their works, for they say and do not. For they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne, and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. But all their works they do for to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments. They love the uppermost rooms at feasts and the chief seats in the synagogues and greetings in the markets and to be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi. But be ye not called Rabbi, for one is your master, even Christ, and all ye are brethren. Now we note here that the phylacteries, that leather box containing Hebrew texts worn by the Jewish men at the morning prayer, kept getting bigger. They kept getting bigger. And the border on the garments kept getting bigger and bigger. And it becomes concerning to me when the church has a standard and there are those that just cannot be satisfied one way or other to blend into harmony in a church body, cannot be just brethren and sisters, cannot just fit in with the agreed acceptable practice. What all is going on behind the scenes in our hearts when that is happening? Part of the Christian life is to find security in the voice of our brethren and sisters speaking to us into practical living. For every mile of road we travel, there are two ditches on each side simultaneously. And not one of us is smart enough, at least I'm not smart enough, to know how to navigate everything that I face in life, with the fact that there's a ditch on either side. Number five, a distaste for tradition can actually hinder God's work in us through his people. Verse 3 says, all therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do, but do not after the works, for they say and do not. And depending on our appreciation or lack of appreciation for a tradition, may cause us to stereotype people in ways that are not right and ways that may impact our choices that could be harmful to us spiritually. I shared a personal illustration at the onstart. Just because of my feelings, I cannot. It would have been dangerous to sidestep the guidelines and the guidance that my ministry tried to give to me in my youth. And I'm glad for the times that I listened, in spite of maybe how it felt inside. Nobody is perfect. There may be some well-meaning traditional people that in living out the gospel practically, they fall flat in some areas, but that doesn't mean that all tradition is wrong. But it's a sad day when we kill God's message to us through someone because we can't stand their tradition. And yet God has something he would like to speak into our life through them, and something we can learn from them. Number 6, traditions can be evaluated and adjusted, but they are always replaced with something. And this is my last point. Traditions can have a way of moving from something that served and a real need at the start, but move into being an accessory as time goes on, because time does change, and there are some slight shifts as we go. And I believe that there are ways to respectfully replace a time-worn tradition with a new one, that and do it without biting the hand that fed us. To do it with appreciation for what this tradition actually did, in spite of the fact that now we're replacing it. I have lived long enough to see the fruit of some self-righteous parents who mock traditions from their past and glibly abandon tradition as hilarious, worthless, something to be abandoned with glee, something to be an ornament in the cupboard, something to be hung on the wall, and it's basically weird, odd, and funny. Guess what their children are doing with the traditions that they value, that they never thought they would take it that far. Traditions should be something that we do value, even though we may not do it exactly that way. It was an attempt to safeguard spiritual life. Some traditions can feel like so much work to us, and I have to think about all the work that you mothers go into in endeavor to have a separated dress and not have a cross-gender dressing between boys and girls. And I had to just think, I wonder where I would be today if my great-great-grandmother would have decided being distinct is just too hard. My boys are going to wear t-shirts, my girls are going to wear t-shirts, I'm going to buy jeans for myself, I'm going to buy jeans for my girls, I'm going to go to the barbershop and get a haircut for myself, I'm going to get a haircut for my girls, it's a lot easier to maintain, and had all kinds of practical reasons why this is just too much hard work, we don't really have to be doing all this. Where do you think we would be this morning if some of those traditions would have been laid aside for practical reasons to make life easier? Where would we be? Do you think the gender confusion all around us today just happened? Do you think that all just happened? Or do you think there was a tradition after tradition laid aside till children are a little confused? It doesn't seem like boys are that different than girls. And let us never forget, when we trade the carrying on the arm shopping basket of life for an easier pushing shopping cart, it gives room for a lot of other things to get put into the cart. And it's going to cost us at checkout. Let's not forget that holds true in our spiritual life and journey as well. Maybe when we switch from a carrying basket to a shopping cart, it feels so innocent and so insignificant. But the repercussions moving into the future could be significant. Let's not just think about ourselves as we evaluate life and what we should be doing with life. Think about those that are coming after us. Let's keep that in mind as we evaluate traditions. May the Lord bless us as we sort through traditions and evaluate what changes may mean in the bigger picture if we choose to step onto a new platform that has not been proven. May God bless us and give us wisdom. Shall we kneel for prayer?